Welcome back, friends. In today's episode, Ishmael discusses capitalism, its distinctive features, and superiority as an economic system. You're listening to Freedom and Virtue, the podcast.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the podcast. I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to say a bad word. You're going to forgive me for it. The bad word is capitalism. Capitalism remains the boogeyman against whom all the forces of all socialism, all the forces of supposed liberation are against. The dreaded word capitalism is still with us, and it is still the cause of much debate. It is hated by many, embraced by others, and misunderstood by most people. Even those who benefit lavishly from it attack it. For example, some of the most bestial attacks against capitalism come from extremely wealthy capitalists. The socialists hear the word, and it conveys to them images of selfishness, greed, exploitation, inequality, war, and imperialism, a scourge over the face of the earth. The intellectual class resorts to envy. Why should I make less than this Rotarian, uneducated guy making millions selling soap? Why should I be the one benefiting, because the world needs my knowledge so much? Knock at the door of any classroom in America, and you will see the scourge of the earth, capitalism, being lambasted, critiqued, and opposed. Envy motivates this hatred. But the hatred is not limited to secular abodes. No, the pulpit-pounding religionist laments the lowering of morals, the greed, and the corruption of affluence, longing for the days when their pontifications were law and their privileges came from the kings. Paul Tillich called capitalism demonic. R.H. Tony spoke of the evils of acquisitiveness, and Max Weber told us that capitalism crushes the human spirit. Hey, we even have a pope in Rome today whose invectives against capitalism are well known. My own life is a witness to how misunderstandings of capitalism can lead one to dedicate a life to attack it until one's eyes are opened. And suddenly the unbearable thought arises, maybe, just maybe, I was wrong about it. I grew up in the 1960s in Puerto Rico, and I grew up in a communist household. My father was founding member of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, at that time called the Movement for Independence. He was there in January of 1959. When the Marxist-Leninist organization was founded. My father was a dedicated Marxist who gave his life for socialism. I have many memories of those days. My days listening to my father's never-ending harangues against Yankee imperialism and capitalism that made the neighbors very unhappy and was so funny to us at home. I remember selling communist propaganda and feeling so special because I was part of this movement, a movement destined to erase the antagonisms of the present order and bring about heaven on earth. There was something intoxicating in the efforts of our family. Our hearts were sown with the thread of utopia. Being communist brought an aura of mystery and exclusivity. We were an embattled community, an enlightened vanguard who one day will erase the problems in the world. One day we will crush the head of the capitalist serpent and erase the social pathologies of my Puerto Rico of the 1960s, and our flag will stand alone. At least that is what my dad said, and I dedicated myself to follow him. I have so many memories of those days. For example, seeing my father tell my mother that I will give the lives of these four children we have at home for revolution, and see my mom cry. And I remember all of us will come to try to console mom, but deep inside of me, there was something intoxicating and appetizing in what my father was telling. I wanted that kind of expectations for my life. I embraced those expectations as a child. Through the years, we moved from one house to the other within the same small neighborhood in the city of Mayagüez in Puerto Rico, my mother's hometown. Our longest lived dwelling was simple and small. Sergeant Vicente Torres and Detective Santos Toro Vargas were FBI agents working in conjunction with the Puerto Rican police to follow my father. The COINTELPRO was a special intelligence collaboration between the FBI and the Puerto Rican police, the co-intelligence program of the FBI. In a document within the FBI file that my father had, and I still have with me, they conducted routine surveillance of our home, and they describe our home this way. Description of the residence: wood house with four waters, zinc roof, chattel style. It has a cement half balcony, and the house is painted yellow. It has one front door and a Miami-style front window. On the east side, the house connects with Garnier Alley, and on its west side, with the patio. There, I spent some of the most wonderful days of my early childhood, and at the same time, I learned how to hate America. I remember one night when my mom, crying again, went to talk with these two men who were always there inside a car in front of our home. And I remember how it felt to see my mother leave the home in the middle of the night. I probably was only about 6 or 7 years of age. I remember the pain and the anguish, not knowing if mom was going to return. And I hated them. I hated them. I blamed them for the Puerto Rican poverty of the 1960s. I blamed them for the bad marriage between mom and dad because my father was more in love with revolution than with her. And my mom only cared about these children we have at home and we cannot feed because my father couldn't keep a job. He will try and here comes the FBI behind him and he will not be able to keep the job. I hated them because Puerto Rico was in a transition period from an agricultural and backward economy into a more modern economy. I blamed capitalism for such condition. At the same time, mom was a beautiful, wonderful mother of the Puerto Rico's 1960s. She cared about her children. She was full of love for us. I remember she used to say, well, if your dad says that we are communists, okay, we are communists. She couldn't care less about politics. She only cared about us. On Sundays, she would allow us to go to mass with friends, and there I developed a sort of double consciousness. I was already enthralled and imbued with the ideas of my father. I have joined eventually the party with him. and began to experience a sort of double consciousness, Marx and Jesus, the kingdom and revolution. It was an exciting and at the same time very confused time in my life. I eventually went to the University of Puerto Rico to study political science because I wanted to intellectually defeat America. But inside of me, the seeds of faith had been planted without those seeds being able to suffocate my Marxist commitments. And what was a good Catholic and Puerto Rican boy eventually to do? Well, I joined the Jesuit order, of course. This is the mid-1980s. Revolution was brewing in Central and South America, and the Jesuits were at the forefront of that effort. And I found that I probably could eat my cake and have it too in the Jesuit order. I could be a Marxist and at the same time a believer. Eventually, I joined the order. My father, who was not necessarily very fond of religion, was in some ways a little jealous of me because he knew the Jesuits. And I was so excited. I did my first vows. I joined the order. And I was going to Nicaragua. They were going to send me to Sandinista Nicaragua to study philosophy. Sandinista Nicaragua, the heart of the revolution. You can imagine what amazing opportunity that was for a revolutionary. I was going to be studying at the feet of the great masters of liberation theology, Ignacio Ellacuría, Juan Luis Segundo, Gustavo Gutierrez, all these men who taught at times at the University of El Salvador. They were probably going to be my professors as I lived in Nicaragua and studied at the University of El Salvador. I have studied the Marxist catechism at home from my father and from communist propaganda coming from Cuba and the Soviet Union for many, many years. But now I was going to be able to do something about it. I was going to join the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua as a Jesuit fighting for the liberation of people. Liberation theology was going to be that tool of bringing about the Marxist expectations of my youth. But it was never to happen. In 1987, 7 Jesuits were murdered in El Salvador, and out of concern for us, they decided not to send us to Nicaragua. And very soon, I was out of seminary. You know, I did not have a vocation to the priesthood. I wanted to be a revolutionary priest in Nicaragua fighting capitalism and fighting America. That's very different. When that was not realized, I left seminary and went back to my little town of Isabela, Puerto Rico, angrier than ever at the world and especially at the capitalist behemoth. They wanted to send me to Fordham here in the United States, and I remember telling them, I'm not going to Fordham, I'm not going to the guts of the monster, as we used to call America in the party. I'm not going there. I hate America. Eventually, however, I landed in America. You can only imagine this black, Hispanic, communist kid lands in Dixie. All my fears were going to be realized. In the beginning, I couldn't understand English. I thought I knew English, but, you know, that southern drawl, that's not English. I couldn't take the food. I couldn't take that which you call coffee. It was a cultural shock, to say the least. And at the same time, I hated the country. A series of events were the beginning of a new understanding in my life. The first thing that happened to me was that I had good grades at the university. In all my classes, the professors were happy with my work, even though I could barely understand the English. I remember taking a tape recorder to class to record the classes and go back to my dorm and try to listen again and again to try to understand what was said, but I had good grades. And one day they called me to the dean's office and offered me a full assistantship, paying me all my studies. And I thought, I hate their guts and they are rewarding me. This is not supposed to be happening. This is supposed to be the hell of the workers. I'm supposed to hate you. And you are doing this for me? This is not supposed to be happening. You know, ideology was filtering that reality. Ideologies are like that, like a filter through which we look at reality. And you and me, we could be looking at the same reality and we will see different things because the prism of understanding is different. Ideologies are like a comfortable pair of glasses we put on ourselves, and through that prism, we experience the essence of existence. And it's very difficult to take away that comfortable pair of glasses and put on a new one. Many of us never had that opportunity. We live in a context, we take certain things for granted, and we are never challenged by a different understanding of reality. And I had that opportunity. I began to see things in a different light. The second thing that happened to me was that I began to experience that which you call poverty here in America is by far a joke. I said, give me some of that poverty, please. In other words, my assumptions about America and about capitalism began to be challenged slowly. It was a process that took 3, 4, 5 years before I could say that I no longer was a socialist, which caused tremendous struggle in my life because I was losing my father at the same time. My father died a good socialist, and he could not accept that the most radical of his sons, the one who could probably be the only one in the family who had an FBI file along him, had basically joined the enemy. It was very painful to not be in speaking terms with my father. It took a lot of reading, Hayek, Mises, Thomas Sowell, Shelby Steele, the great David Horowitz, and many, many other men who opened a new understanding, a new universe of knowledge that I did not know existed. All of that was Yankee propaganda. You stay away from that. We have the truth of socialism. When I began to study those ideas, they opened a new understanding in my life. And I never forget when my father, who never understood and accepted why I have surrendered socialism, told me, Ismael, if that's what you believe, is that what you now accept, something that I cannot accept, you better not be a fence sitter. You better fight for what you say that you believe, because that is what he did with his life. And I think that is the revolutionary zeal that we are losing in America, a revolutionary zeal that allows us to speak boldly for the ideas in which we believe. Today, I salute capitalism and I embrace it. One day I will continue and finish the story of my life in America, but today I salute capitalism. It is the economic system that better maximizes both growth and individual liberty. Capitalism succeeds because it is adaptive, not rigid. Whereas so much regulation often fails despite good intentions. It is superior because it embraces human fallibility instead of attempting to eliminate it. Its anthropology is sound. The human person is creative and productive, and in unleashing these potentials, we can create unimaginable wealth for the immense majority of human beings. It is superior because, believe it or not, it is humble. It is not a comprehensive system with an answer to the mysteries of life. It is narrow in its pretensions. If you want greater production, do this. Don't blame capitalism because it doesn't give you what it never promised to give to you. Capitalism succeeds because in reality, not in an a priori concept in my mind, has demonstrated to be effective in creating a steady rise in the wage earners' standards of living. Through trial and error, capitalism allows for experiential learning as the best alternative over ideological aims or whims. Don't tell me how society ought to be. Tell me how I can make lemonade out of the lemon of existence. That is capitalism. As the great late Michael Novak tells us in his masterly The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, a book that you must read if you aspire to ever complete your learning in economic freedom. And I quote, "Of all the systems of political economy which have shaped our history, none has so revolutionized ordinary expectations of human life, lengthened the lifespan, made the elimination of poverty and famine thinkable, enlarged the range of human choice as democratic capitalism." End of quote. For most of human history, the economy remained static, a steady state of poverty and low production. People aspired to survive. Subsistence was all they could aspire for. People lived meager and short lives, and trade was mostly localized. Growth is a reality that is relatively recent. A relatively recent phenomenon. In the year 1500, global production was about $250 billion in present terms. Today, it is around $60 trillion. Even Karl Marx admits that in 80 years, capitalism produced more wealth than the entire human existence had produced in 2,000 years before the advent of capitalism. People were less mobile. They traded for what they needed from those closer to them or barter for supplies. Wealth was concentrated on the land, and the major landowners were few. Either through chattel slavery or through the enslaving of peasants to the land, production was scarce. Society was irremediably stratified, and privilege was destiny, and so was dependency on the powerful.
Before Ishmael continues this engaging conversation, I'd like to remind listeners to send any comments, questions, or reactions about today's topic, or any topic discussed on the show, to ismael@fvinstitute.org. If these issues are resonating with you, and I'm sure they are, we'd love to hear your feedback. Every email will be read and responded to in upcoming episodes. If you'd like to invite Ishmael to come and lecture on one of the topics discussed in this podcast, you may email him at ismael@fvinstitute.org. You can also learn more about the work of the Freedom and Virtue Institute over at the website www.fvinstitute.org. Now, back to the discussion with Ishmael.
With capitalism came an optimism that was new in human existence. The despised merchant could aspire to a quality of life that rivaled and surpassed that of the aristocrat and the ecclesial class. Optimism about progress in the future is what began to drive our economic system, and without it, there's no growth. This is an important piece of history and origin of capitalism that is forgotten, denied, or covered under the weight of unfair accusations. Optimism about progress in the future is essential to capitalism. Until relatively recently, distrust in the future did not exist, and this limited the growth of the economy. We can romanticize the slow pace of the past with its eyes on the heavens, but that is all it is, romantic dribble. In the past, money could convert almost anything into almost anything else, but those things had to exist. Excellent description. It couldn't represent the resources one could hope to have in the future once an enterprise started making a profit. It was simply a description of the present, a way to acquire present wealth without the expectation of future wealth. In an economy without trust in the future, banks wouldn't loan you money. For what? The only way one could build an enterprise would be to find a contractor willing to wait to be paid until after the business was built and making a profit. As this wouldn't be likely, the enterprise never existed, never began to exist. As many people face this problem of resources, the economy remained stagnant. The same people remain in power, the poor stayed poor, and the rich stayed rich. The lie that they tell about capitalism is precisely the condition that capitalism changed for good. Credit is founded on the optimistic assumption that the future will have more abundant resources than the present, because money could only represent things that actually existed before capitalism. Wealth was limited. In other words, there was only so much money to go around. If one candy store was prospering, that meant that the other down the street was starving. A set amount of wealth meant that if you had it, it was because you were taking it away from someone else, or you have been given it by your aristocratic ancestry. There was no hope for change in the future. That came with the dreaded and hated capitalism. Yes, there was wealth before capitalism came into the picture. But who had it? A few people. And why? Because they were born in privilege. The only system in history that has eliminated privilege as destiny is capitalism. You heard me right. You socialists, you heard me right. You cannot eliminate privilege, because in socialism, you need conformity with the dictates of those with political power. Apart from that conformity, you have nothing. I repeat, the only system in human history that has eliminated privilege as destiny is capitalism. So spare me your supply of soupy ideology about rich privilege or white privilege. Spare me the lie. If resources were fixed and scant, that meant a zero-sum game that had to be sinful. Before capitalism, that is what you had, a zero-sum game. Some have it, others don't, and that is it. Many people thought that being rich was either a blessing from the heavens that could not be challenged or aspired for, or a great evil, a great sin, to aspire for. So wealth meant that you have been blessed or that you were sinning. Little by little, with small merchants leading the way, people started to see that their wealth was independent from the poverty of others. And this is so important. Their wealth was independent from the poverty of others. In fact, creating wealth and benefiting from it was a public good, a good for the whole of society. Adam Smith, in his Wealth of Nations, contended that an employer's profit benefits society because the employer reinvests his profit in hiring more people, and those other people can feed their families. By hiring more employees, the employer more widely spreads the business profits. In the past, rulers and the wealthy had spent their wealth on ornaments, tournaments, palaces, banquets, wars, and charities. Now, they were expected to reinvest their profits into production, which would increase profits, which could then be reinvested, continuing a cycle of expanding the reach of profits. Amazing. This reinvested money is called capital. Capital is the term for money and resources that are invested in the production of a product or service. In other words, its value transcends the actual physical property. Consider the world that existed as Adam Smith was writing The Wealth of Nations. Mercantilism was king. It was as if the economy existed for the glory of the nation. It did not exist to satisfy the basic needs of the populace. Now, the populace existed to glorify the nation by the accumulation of precious metals and other resources. Once a generation, famines wiped great portions of the civilized world. Plagues killed throngs of people. Sizable number of people devoted their whole income to acquire a little bread to survive. Life expectancy in France, for example, was 27 years old. And that's for women. And for men, 23.4 years. Those who journeyed afar will come back feeling sorry for the conditions they found in Africa and Asia, far worse than dilapidated Europe. Illiteracy was virtually universal, and great swaths of the world did not know about the wheel. Medicine was more witchcraft than something else. After a steady state of pain, suffering, and want, after 5 millennia of dry existence, something reigned over the face of humanity. Men finally figured out the key to the sustainable and systematic creation of wealth, and that is called capitalism. In Great Britain, large industrial cities emerged, and throngs of people escaped the rural lands and ventured to try for a better life in the factories. In spite of the lore now fed to impressionable youngsters about how corrupt and evil early capitalism was, the reality is that they misunderstand that history, and we will continue that next time. At this moment, I want to remind you that I am the executive director and founder of the Freedom and Virtue Institute. We stand for the values of freedom and the virtues of enterprise that make freedom a reality. We ask for your support. I ask for your support. Now more than ever, as these ideas of freedom, the capitalist system, the market economy, the free economy, are under assault, now more than ever, we need those who stand for these ideas that made our country and our civilization great. So I ask for your support. You can go to our website, www.fvinstitute.org, and support us. You can call me directly at 239-240-9393, or you can email me at the email that you will be given shortly. Thank you so much, and we will continue this interesting story of capitalism next time.
Thank you for listening to Freedom and Virtue, the podcast. Now, learn more about the Freedom and Virtue Institute by visiting www.fvinstitute.org. Ishmael is also the author of the book, Not Tragically Colored. You can connect with him on the Freedom and Virtue Institute Facebook page. And don't forget to subscribe and give us a positive review. Thanks. Until next time, stay engaged. I was thinking this was the way to go, and you put up your puppet show. I say cheers to you.